Well, again, I want to thank both Charlie and Carl, all who took part this weekend, for a very good time. I'm sure it will continue to bear fruit for quite a while to come. When I had some thoughts, more general thoughts of my own, and some of the specific things they have given to us today. I don't know if you've ever had the experience, you're reading a book, you're reading along, and you come to a passage that just kind of stops you cold for a few minutes. I can do that. That happens with me. I'll be cruising along, having a pretty good read, and then I'll come to something that'll stop me dead and cause me to kind of stare off and think a little bit and do some reflecting. This happened to me just recently. I was reading a review written by Gary Wills in the New York Review of Books of Taylor Branch's latest biography of Martin Luther King. Actually, the book is the third of a trilogy of a biography that Mr. Branch has written. Only this one is called A Canaan's Edge. It covers the years of Dr. King's life from the summit of Montgomery March in 1965 to his assassination in 1968, and it's called A Canaan's Edge. In the course of his review, Wills writes of the shaky start the summit of Montgomery March got off to, including the concern as to whether or not there are enough support for him. Including the concern of whether or not enough support could be garnered for the march to even happen. And then Wills notes, when King issued a call for religious leaders to join him in Selma for a renewed march on March the 9th, the outpouring of hundreds of clergy from many faiths clogged the airways. Dr. King had built up a network of ecumenical religious trust. A few lines later, Wills writes, I thought instantly of the difference between this outpouring of religious support for the beaten marchers and the eruption for the beaten marchers and the eruption of right-wing religiosity that sent the president hurrying to Washington to block a court order on Terry Schiavo's condition. Then Wills closes his paragraph with these words. There was a time, not so long ago, when religion was a force for liberation in America. And that was when I had to stop reading. There was a time, not so long ago, when religion was a force for liberation in America. I actually had to go walk that one off. The time of which Wills writes was approximately at the same time that I was preparing for the ministry in those rather heady days of the late 1960s and early 70s. And I read that sentence and I thought, how did we get from a time when religion was a force for liberation in America to a time when it is largely now a force for retraction, retrenchment, and reaction? I have to say, in truth and fairness, it has never been entirely one or the other. The double-edged sword of religion is that it can be a force that calls us to our better and more exalted selves, or it can cater to and reinforce some of our deepest fears and prejudices and bigotries. It has always been thus. But Wills makes a good and telling point. There has been a cultural shift over the past 40 years when it comes to the role that religion has played in American society, or of the way that role has been perceived, let us say. As just noted, I prepared for the ministry in that time in a liberal mainline Protestant Christian venue at a time when religion in America, in a very meaningful way, was playing a liberating and transformative role. But I have to acknowledge that ministry in those days was almost entirely a guy thing. Nearly all of my seminary classmates were young men, like myself, in our early 20s, fresh out of college, certainly wet between the ears, behind the ears when it had to do with any sort of ministerial savvy. It scares me to this day to think of how little I knew when I first entered the ministry. But we still had our models for ministry, and they were people like Martin Luther King, and William Sloan Coffin, who was in the chaplain at Yale University, and those Jesuit brothers, fathers Dan and Phil Berrigan. Now, few of any of us felt that we were actually going to go out and have the same kind of high-profile social justice, social activist ministries that these members of the clergy were having. We didn't think we would be doing the same things they did, but we did see them as exemplars of what it meant to bring the values and the moral imperatives of one's religion into the public arena. Ways to transform society and enhance the public good. Well, all of these things, that was all that came back to me as I just read that one single sentence by Gary Wills. There was a time, not so long ago, when religion was a force for liberation in America. I'm afraid that over the past three decades or so, liberal or progressive religion has lost in good measure that public voice that it had when I prepared for the ministry. Reasons for this are well beyond the scope of what I briefly had to say today. Some of it was the fault of religious liberals ourselves, some not. But I am coming to believe that maybe today liberal religion is beginning to find its public voice again. Perhaps there are some straws in the wind. I was impressed by the number of clergy and lay leaders, not just Unitarian Universalists, who testified against the proposed constitutional amendment in our own state house a few weeks ago that would have practically made it impossible for same-sex couples to ever gain access to legal marriage in our state. That amendment was soundly defeated. We still have a long ways to go on this one, but at least on this one particular measure, progressive religious voices were heard. But if progressive religion is to find its voice again in our society, I don't think it will be primarily through some of the more dramatic and high-profile ways we saw some 35 to 40 years ago. There may be some of that, but I think it will happen more on a congregation-by-congregation basis. It will be when persons of progressive religious faith within their faith communities begin to search with one another for ways in which we can bring the principles and values we hold dear into the public arena. And that's what we were doing this past weekend. We cannot wait for another Martin Luther King to come along. That could happen, I guess, but let's not hold our breath. Let us instead use our breath, our voices, our energies, our ideas to seek and act on ways that we can indeed advocate the inherent worth and dignity of all persons, for ways we can advance justice, equity, and compassion in human relations, for ways we can work together towards the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all. You see, we've got the language. Those are the words from our purposes and principles. We've got the language. Now all we have to do, is put our lives and our congregational energies behind it. For I really do believe that religion can be a force for liberation in this community and in this nation. And it will happen, I believe, as our more progressive-minded congregations find their voices again, even as we shall continue to do. It can happen. To go back to the Selma story for just a minute, what saved that march? What made it happen when it looked like it was going to fail was, as Taylor Branch points out, when Dr. King put out a nationwide call for religious leaders to join him. And the reason they came to Selma in droves is because Dr. King and his compatriots in the Southern Christian Leadership Conference had been spending the previous 10 years following the Montgomery bus boycott, developing relationships with like-minded persons of faith in congregations, in denominational conferences, on seminary campuses, one by one, so that when 10 years had gone by and the word went out, there was that response. So take heed and take heart. Well, I want to leave you with a story, the days I've been recalling. I remember about 1968-69, Colgate Rochester Divinity School, Rochester, New York, with Dick Gilbert over at the, just beginning his ministry at the Unitarian Church there. And William Sloan Coffin paid a visit to our campus. He was just coming off a pretty high-profile trial where he'd been convicted of aiding and abetting young men to avoid the Vietnamese War. That conviction was later overturned because the trial itself had really been nothing more than a political attempt to silence Reverend Coffin's voice in opposition to the war itself. So what I remember is he stands up there in this dining room, we're all sitting around, and he says, "All right, listen up, boys. Now, like I said, ministry was a guy thing in those days. And when an older and more seasoned minister would decide he had to impart a little wisdom to a bunch of fledgling upstart ministers, he would actually say things like, "Listen up, boys." And when you're a 23-year-old seminarian and Bill Coffin growls at you to listen up, well, you listen up. And here's what he said. He said he knew that most of us would be going into the parish ministry. He said that's where we needed to be. That's where he eventually himself wound up at New York's Riverside Church. And he said, if you take good care of your congregation, if you love them when they need to be loved, if you care about them when they need to be cared about, when you give them comfort when they need comfort, he went on, well then, boys, they won't care if you're a card-carrying communist when you go out to do your public ministry. I think he was stretching it just a bit on that one. But his basic point was sound. He was saying that it is how well you attend to the needs of your congregation that give you the entree to the ministry of social activism. And that principle isn't just for ministers. That goes for congregational life as well. Because within a congregation, it is how well you care for one another that opens up the ways in which you also care for the wider world. And that, I feel, is what it means to be a social justice congregation. It is a congregation that loves and cares about and seeks justice for its members and friends in the way that it seeks to love and care about and seek justice for the world outside its walls. It's all part of the same piece of cloth. And I feel blessed in being a minister of a congregation that has found and continues to seek ways to do both, to care for one another as we care for the world. So this little story is my lead into the final part of our service today as we give a special word of thanks and tribute to Nathaniel Gross for his kindness, his generosity of spirit as a member of this congregation, are indeed a part of the same piece of cloth that he long has worn as an advocate for peace and justice and fairness and equality in the various places he's lived his life in this community and in the past 20 years. So I recognize Adrian George, I'll get it right. Come on, guys. Oh, and the members of the committee, yeah. Whoever's doing this, please come forward.
I remember that first meeting. I remember being greeted by a warm and engaging gentleman who welcomed me graciously into the committee. It was my first introduction to Nathaniel, the person who had become not only my truest role model, but also a dear friend. In the 13 years on the Social Justice Committee, I've had the opportunity to share a lot of meetings, events, conversations with Nathaniel. If Nathaniel wasn't organizing an event himself, he was always offering to help, to create a flyer, to contact a speaker, to facilitate a discussion, to write a letter, to be our spokesperson. What I've seen is Nathaniel's untiring commitment to the causes of peace, social and economic justice, and all the struggles for making this world a better place. But no matter what was going on, Nathaniel always valued our personal exchanges, the sharing of events in our personal lives, and news about our families. I feel honored by the friendship I've been able to have with both Nathaniel and Jeanette. Nathaniel generously gives his humor, his knowledge and wisdom, and his friendship, not just to those of us on the Social Justice Committee, but to so many in our congregation. And I know I speak for a lot of people when I thank him for all that he's given us. Nathaniel, thank you for sharing so many interesting articles, magazines, books, and websites. Thank you for the dynamic speakers that you brought to the church and the opportunities you've given us to get involved. Thank you for your leadership and the insight and wisdom you always lend to our discussions. Thank you for speaking out on all the causes you believe so passionately about. And finally, Nathaniel, I want to thank you for the way you inspire all of us to lead lives of greater contribution.
I feel grateful to have the opportunity to participate in honoring Nathaniel today. In my mind, Nathaniel and social justice are synonymous. His life as a testimony from civil rights to peace and everything in between as a sterling model for a committed citizen working for a better world. I thought of no better illustration of Nathaniel's careful, thoughtful, and personally engaging way of approaching issues and touching people's lives than to share from Nathaniel's own thinking. And do this by sharing a piece of his writing, which was written on February 4th, 2003, in the build-up to the Iraq War. It's entitled, A Personal Statement on War. As once a young man who volunteered for military service right after Pearl Harbor, because I knew war was necessary and warranted at that point, and now an octogenarian who has witnessed many wars that were not necessary nor warranted, and as one who knows that war is the ultimate horror and human tragedy and must be launched, if at all, as truly a last resort, and as a person who tries to live by enlightened values, I have tried as simply and as succinctly as I can to create the criteria I would use to determine my stand on war or warlike action proposed by any nation. I do this less to promote my views and more to encourage others to state what they believe, and perhaps we can all have a better discussion about the present crisis. For me to consider a war defensible, unless it is a response to actual or imminent direct attack upon one's country, it would have to meet at least the following four criteria. One, the reason for the war and the objective would have to be extremely important and urgent. Two, the motives of the country pushing for the war would have to be very meritorious. I refer not to proclaimed aims, which are always noble, but to the aims inferred by considering history, ideology, the character of government leadership, and other clues. Third, every possibility of resolving the matter without war must have been sincerely tried first. Fourth, even if these tests have been met, a final question remains. In the given instance, is a war better than doing nothing? Will a good come out of so great and desirable that the killing, devastation, suffering, disease, and the hatred engendered are acceptable to people of conscience? A question: does the proposed rush to war against Iraq meet these criteria or yours? Finally, I want to thank Nathaniel and his spouse, Jeanette, nearly 60 years, who are approaching rapidly, for their graciousness, their loving kindness that they extended to Hillary and I, and many people in our church congregation and our community at large. I salute you for all you have done or you continue to do to make this a better world. Thank you.
Nathaniel, this is a message from Roy. Nathaniel has been a labor organizer and social activist for many, many years. He continues to set the example and to inspire me and many others through his words and his deeds. His speeches and participation in rallies against the invasion and occupation of Iraq, his involvement in GSOP, and so many other issues of social justice. Nathaniel is this wonderful person in whom the qualities of compassion, righteous indignation, determination, fairness, optimism, thoughtfulness, and outrage have come together. These qualities continue to move him to speak out, to take action, to put himself on the line. I wish I could have been there today to share this moment. Best wishes, Nathaniel. I know you will keep up the fight.
I don't know how much more I can say. I'd like to say something very personal. You know, I think all of us, when we look back on our life, we can, you know, think of a very small handful of people that have had a lot of influence in our lives. You know, could be our parents, could be a sports coach, could be a university professor, someone who's, you know, just the fact that you met that person, you know, really made a dramatic change in your own life. And I think, you know, definitely Nathaniel definitely falls in that category. I definitely put him in the pantheon of people who have had a great deal of effect on me in my life. I think there's another thing that I've learned from Nathaniel, you know, aside from all the really nice things that my colleagues have just said, but I think the one thing I've learned is that as I get older, the one disease of humankind that I have to avoid is the disease of cynicism. You know, that I try, you know, thinking positive, that I, you know, be hopeful, and that I persevere. And I think for, you know, from you, Nathaniel, that's the greatest gift you've given me. Thank you very much.
Social Justice Committee to come up to the front of the sanctuary, as well as Steve and Harry. To thank Jack Wigio for lovingly putting this together. You know, we approached Dick the last minute. He didn't have that much time. And, you know, we're all very grateful that he spent the time putting this together. Anyway, I'd like to read the certificate that we'll be presenting to Nathaniel. To Nathaniel Brooks, the Social Justice Committee of the Unitarian Universalist Church of Nashua recognizes you for your untiring dedication to peace, social fairness, and economic justice. We honor you for your inspiration, your generosity of spirit, and the dedication you have given throughout your lifetime to making this world a better place.